what's going to cause cap rates to deflate is just simply going to be transaction velocity, because cap rates are already deflated. You just can't see it because nothing is selling. When things actually start to sell, the cap rates will reveal themselves. We'll find that they're higher than people think.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What's going on, everybody? You know the drill. Every Monday, we're coming at you all things multifamily real estate investing. Some days I come out here solo and share my experiences, the good, the bad, the ugly. Other times I bring on a guest. And today that's the case. I'm bringing on a high quality guest. But before I get into who it is, housekeeping as always. The purpose of the show is I want to help others create the life of their dreams, especially financially, because there's two things in this world that can change your life. And that's obviously money, but more importantly, time. But first, we need to cover the money thing, right? To cover our expenses before we can have the time to spend it on the things we want to do with the people we want to do it when we want to do it. In order to do that, I need to get this in front of more people, not only share my experiences, but share with them experiences of people that are even more successful than I am. In order to do that again, we need to get in front of more ears and eyes. So if you find value from this and you know someone else could find value from this show, please share it with them. Post on your social media, send a link to a friend. And also, if you haven't, leave a rating and review, because that really helps with the algorithms, both on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. And if you watch on YouTube, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. That's how we get in front of more people. All right. Now, our guest for today is Brian Burke. I'm sure most of people listening knows who that is, but if you haven't, he is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital, which is a vertically integrated real estate private equity investment firm, which he founded in 2001. Brian has acquired over $800 million worth of real estate over a 30-year career, including over 4,000 multifamily units and more than 700 single-family homes with the assistance of proprietary software that he wrote himself. Brian has subdivided land, built homes, and constructed self-storage, but really prefers to reposition existing multifamily properties. Well, Brian has come to the right place to talk about that, because this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. And Brian, which is most people probably know him, he has a big presence on Bigger Pockets, but he is the author of The Hands-Off Investor, an insider's guide to investing in passive real estate syndications. And he's also a public speaker at real estate conferences and events nationwide. This was awesome show, guys. We talk about how he went from a grocery clerk transacting and operating over $800 million worth of real estate over his career. You know, we talk about, is Brian pencils down? And for those that aren't familiar with that term, is he still looking at deals? Is he still underwriting deals? Or is he taking a step back? So we ask him that question. We get into picking the right sponsor, because this is an important thing. And that's what his whole book is about. It's for the lens of a limited partner, for a passive investor. It really is good for an active investor too, because it shows what passive investors should be looking for and how active investors should be operating. So we get into that. And then he also talks about trust circles and the trust that is required to really use OPM, other people's money. It's about that sponsor and really building trust between the sponsor and the investor. Guys, we also talk about what's going on in the market. Obviously, neither of us have a crystal ball, but it was just a really great conversation on what's happening and kind of where things could potentially go. In the end, it's all about just being diligent, both in buying properties, underwriting, operating. So without further ado, I'm really excited about this, guys. This is a great episode. I had a blast and learned a ton, and I'm sure you will do the same. So without further ado, here's Brian Burke. Hey, Brian, it's an honor to have you on the show. It's truly a privilege. So thank you for taking time out of your day and welcome to the Multifamily Money Podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Sean.
All right, man. Well, let's just get right into it. For those that aren't familiar, I probably talked about this in the intro already, but Brian, you start off as a grocery clerk, and now you've transacted and operated over $800 million worth of real estate. That just blows my mind. I would love to just...
Got to start somewhere, Sean.
Hey, I feel you. I started mowing lawns and shoveling snow, so I'm with you. So how did that happen?
Well, I just didn't have any better ideas, I guess. I got hired in a grocery store when I was 16 years old, and while that was a good job, it wasn't what I had considered to be my career aspiration. I really wanted to be an airline pilot. And I got my pilot's license while I was in high school in preparation for becoming an airline pilot, and then realized that I needed like another $35,000 to finish all the flight training and get all the flight experience and everything that I needed to get all the licenses to become an airline pilot. And I didn't have $35,000. So I was like, well, now what am I going to do? I know I don't have any money. I don't know anyone. I don't know anything. So I'll invest in real estate. That seems like a viable path. So that's what I set my mind to doing. And somehow over the years, I've managed to accomplish it. I bought my first house when I was like 20 years old as an investment property with no money down because I convinced the seller to carry back the down payment. Then it just never stopped.
And credit to you there, because when you mentioned you didn't have $35,000, I think a lot of mental hurdles for people in real estate specifically are they don't have the money to start. But case in point right here is you don't necessarily need it.
I didn't have it.
And I guess this leads me to my next question of what would you advise maybe, when I say younger, I don't mean necessarily in age, but younger in terms of experience when it comes to real estate. Where would you advise usually to start? You got a lot of gurus out there saying go big. And obviously we get that from scale, from a business aspect. But is that truly, do you think that's truly the best place to start for someone starting out?
Well, if you can, sure. I mean, if you have millions of dollars of money sitting in a trust fund or in a bank, or you just sold a business and you've got a lot of money, yeah, go big, because you can leverage, you can scale, the numbers are meaningful. But if that's not your situation, you have to start wherever you can start. And for me, as a 20-year-old with no experience and no money and no friends of that had money and no contacts or anything like that, buying a $10 million property, might as well try to just build a slingshot that will take me to the moon. I mean, there's just no way that was going to happen.
Yeah.
So I had to start where I could. And for me, that first house was $80,000 or so, you know, something like that. I mean, it wasn't certainly a big purchase, but it was all I could do. And I could do it because I found a seller that would carry back the down payment. I'm not going to find a seller that'll carry back the down payment and a lender that would give me a loan on a large property under that set of circumstances. It's just not going to happen. So you have to start where you have the means to start. And that's what's more important is starting. It's not about the size. It's not about scale. It's about starting, doing something, going out, putting one foot in front of the other and growing your business over time. If that's the only way you can do it, which is the case for most people, it's not a waste of your time. Trust me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think to your point of just starting and doing something, I don't think people get it. To be a real estate investor, you got to buy something, right? You got to actually start. I think that's important because a lot of people, analysis paralysis and just thinking they need to learn more or get in the right position, but just start. And yeah, to me, there's nothing wrong starting smaller, right? And now to your point, if you do have the resources to go bigger, do go bigger. But I guess my next question would be, so how were you able to scale and go bigger?
Other people's money. It took a long, long, long time. I mean, it wasn't easy. You buy that one house and you fix it up and then eventually you resell it and you do that again and then you do that again and then you do that again. And then you buy two and do it again. And then you buy three and do it again. And then you buy four and do it again. So it just takes time. And like, I think the big thing for me, what got me kind of most noticed was just having done that much activity, finally started getting noticed by other people that I knew, and they would tell people that they knew. And now all of a sudden I'm getting calls from people going like, hey, what you're doing is interesting. I want to invest in something like that, but I don't know how to do it. And it's like, well, you can invest with me and I'll do all that work and you can invest your capital. And it starts that way. And geez, the first fund I did, I had a $5,000 minimum. That's how small of an investment I would take. And you grow and you build a track record. And then eventually, now I got thousands of investors, most of which are accredited investors, meaning more than $1 million net worth, generally speaking. And when I started, I knew no one that could fit that definition. So it just takes time, it takes track record, and it takes trust. People have to trust that if they give you their money, you're going to do something good with it and make sure that you give it back along with a return. And until they trust that that's what you're going to be able to do, you're not going to find that money. So it just takes time for that to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Time and repetition.
And talking about track record and trust, finding a deal sponsor, to me, if I was looking at this through the lens of a limited partner, which we'll touch on later, but that's what your book is in the lens of a limited partner. What should they be looking for? Because to me, that's the most important part. It's obviously you got to do due diligence on the deal, but first, I think you need to do due diligence on the operator, on the sponsor.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about it, right? You know, I was going to be an airline pilot. Okay, so that was going to be my career aspiration. Now, if you're going to be an airline passenger, you want to know that the pilot flying that plane knows what they're doing. right? I mean, you want to know they've been properly licensed, they've been properly trained, they have experience. That's all important. I mean, who really does due diligence on the aircraft? Right. What kind of inspections has it had? You know, nobody really thinks about that. People want to know if this pilot's any good. You have a nice soft landing. Oh, that was a good pilot. Really knew what he was doing, or she, right? That's the important piece. And as a brand new real estate investor, your passengers have no reason to trust you because you haven't been trained and have experience and gone through certifications and all this other stuff. So the only way they're going to get on that plane with you is if they know that you're not going to kill them. And so how do you do that? You do that by having a track record to show them, here's the investments I've done, before and after pictures, how much money we invested and how much money I gave back. Here's the returns I generated. Whatever it might be that can show that prospective investor that you have the proper certification, so to speak, and you're not going to kill them, that's what they want to see. And so how do you build that? One step at a time and document everything you do. Just doing a house flip, it's not a waste of time. Take good before and after pictures, make a nice presentation to show what you bought it for, what it looked like when you bought it, what it looked like when you sold it, what you sold it for, how much return you made. Compile all that data so that when you go talk to somebody, you can show them that. And they'll want to invest with you because from the lens of a limited partner, which is the investor, the passive investor, you want to know that the person that you're getting on board with is qualified to have your hard-earned dollars solely in their hands.
Yeah. And to your point of documentation, first of all, everyone likes a good before and after and loves following the journey. So I agree. And I've talked to the institutional side of our world, and that's what they're about. They're about really doing due diligence on that pilot and following the journey. I've had them tell me that they'll follow along for a year or two before they even consider. So I'm sure you've probably run into the same thing. So I think it's important to document what you're doing and being completely transparent, both in the ups and downs, because I've had both ups and downs. I'm sure you've had it. I wouldn't trust anyone that says they haven't had any downs. So
that just means they haven't been doing it long enough yet.
Yeah.
Or haven't been active enough. Yes, that's right. We all have our good deals and our bad deals. And anybody that says, oh, I've never had a bad deal, that just means that the next one might be when the luck runs out.
For sure. So I couldn't agree with you more. And you've already hit on a lot of this, but I've heard you mention the frame or the, excuse me, term circle of trust. Could you just explain that? You obviously talked a little bit about it, but I know there's probably some more pieces that you haven't touched on.
Yeah. So that's any time that an investor is making an investment in a passive investment. Now, I don't care if you're on the sponsor side or the passive investor side, this applies either way. But from the active operator side, here's what this looks like. There's three trust circles. Now, you want somebody to invest money in your deal. And people wonder oftentimes, like, why can't I get anybody to invest in it? And it's because there's three trust circles you have to complete. And if you don't complete all three of them, no one's making that investment. And the first one is the passive investor has to trust the type of investment that you're making. So if you're doing real estate and you tell the investor, I got this great real estate investment. And they're like, oh, real estate's toxic. That's like catching a falling knife. That's dangerous. It's all a big scam. It's a game. It's a get rich quick. I see the late night TV commercials. If that's what that investor thinks, they're not going to invest with you, no matter how much they like you and no matter what great of a deal you have. If they think real estate is all a bunch of bunk, they're not investing in it, period, end of story. Now, a lot of people focus a lot of their efforts in convincing people that real estate is good. And so they'll go to like self-directed IRA seminars. You should be investing in real estate and that sort of stuff. Well, that's a big educational hill to climb and you might be wasting your time. The second trust circle is they have to trust you. So you are the operator, you're in charge, you're in control, you're calling the shots, you're executing the business plan. If an investor is like, gosh, I love real estate, but you don't know what the hell you're doing, they're not going to invest with you. Period, end of story. So that's where this track record comes in. That's where showing them your before and after pictures, the performance history, the number of deals you've done, take them drive by some of the projects that you're doing, whatever that might be, you have to show people that they can trust you. And then the third is they have to trust the deal. So if they're like, hey, love real estate, you're awesome, but that thing you're buying right now is a total piece of junk on the wrong side of town, and it's dilapidated and it's eaten by termites. There's no way that deal is going to work out. They're still not going to write that check. So they have to trust the deal. You have to show them something that it's worthy of them investing in and that you have a plan on how you're going to generate a return for them with this property. If you can complete all three of those trust circles, people will invest with you. If you cannot complete any one of them, you take out any one of them. Doesn't have to be all three. Doesn't have to be two. Take out any one of them. It's not happening for you. That's what I call my circles of trust.
No, I love that. And yeah, I hope you don't keep showing deals to people that they don't trust in, because then they might actually lose trust in you if you're just showing them the junk. But that's so true. Somehow are able to get someone in a deal that may not trust real estate. To me, that's not someone you want in the deal anyways, because that's probably going to be your biggest headache, because you're going to have to continually convince them. So yeah, I think I agree with you on all three. It not only makes their life easier, but yours as well, and way smoother. All right. Well, I guess next I'd love to talk about kind of the deal. You mentioned deals, right? So I've heard you say recently that your pencil's down. Is that still the same, Brian?
Well, I would say we're holding our pencil.
Okay.
We set it on the desk for a while and walked away from it. We've now picked the pencil up and we're holding it, but we're not writing any stories with it yet. By that, I mean, we're underwriting deals.
Yeah.
We're looking at stuff that's coming across. We're just not finding anything that's going to get anywhere remotely close to working for us. For a while, we didn't even bother. We knew it was just a complete waste of time. Maybe we would underwrite a deal a month or something just to stay in touch with the market or whatever. Now we're underwriting a lot more. We're underwriting several deals a week, but still, again, not finding anything. It's just a matter of time, but I still think it's a little bit early. You know, the only way that we're going to find something that we can transact on right now is if there's just some kind of an extreme, unique circumstance, a highly motivated seller, just a distressed situation, something along that line. But the market's in a state of transition and flux. And what you don't want to be doing is riding it down. We sold 3/4 of our portfolio at the peak of the market in 2021 and the first half of 2022.
Great timing.
And then we sat and watched as everything kind of fell 10, 15, 20% in the commercial real estate space. I'm talking about large multifamily, not single family homes. And so we've watched values tumble as interest rates have risen and insurance costs have gone up and payroll expenses have gone up and repair and maintenance expenses have gone up. All of that erodes net operating income, which erodes value, and then cap rate decompression further erodes value. And rent growth went from 10 or 20% a year to like nothing or negative. And, you know, we've sat on the sidelines and watched all of that happen. And once we can get some definition to where the market's actually going, then we'll start taking our underwriting a little bit more seriously.
Yeah. Once the dust settles. Talking about the dust, as we speak right now, a lot has transpired over the last, what, 4 or 5 business days. Silicon Valley Bank kind of blew up, I guess, right? We won't get into the details, but due to fractional banking, right, they made a lot more, let's just say, keep it high level. They lent out and invested more than they had in deposits. And then there was a run on deposits. And yeah, so now Signature Bank went under as well. And Credit Suisse, their largest backer, now saying they won't back them any further. And rates have fallen off a cliff. The market's fallen off a cliff. And so now, Brian, I'm sure this is your favorite question. If you had a crystal ball, where do you think things are going? That Fed funds rate, the futures was priced in at about a little over 4.8 for December 2023, and now it's sub 4%. Where do you think things are going?
Well, perhaps my opinion may prove to be somewhat controversial, but it's difficult for me to predict where things are going when the catalyst for this movement is an incompetent government.
Yeah.
We have a Fed chair and a Fed board who hears from the consumer, the price of bacon's too high. And their response basically is, well, we're from the government and we're here to help. So we will increase your house payment, vaporize your retirement, and get you fired. That's basically their response. And they will not stop until they've caused severe damage to the economy. And if you wonder why SVB collapses, it's because they invested in what they thought at the time was the safest investment in the United States, and that's US Treasuries. And then the Fed goes and raises interest rates dramatically and quickly and erodes the value of the very treasuries that were thought to be so safe. Now, set aside for a moment whether or not investing in long-term treasuries when you have short-term deposits is a smart move. That's for smarter people than me to decide. But when you have a strategy from the regulators that isn't in tune with reality. I mean, basically, they're saying we're going to break inflation by raising interest rates when the cause of inflation is their very own spending. Until there's rationality inserted into those that are making these decisions, the direction of where we're going is very difficult to predict, which is one of the reasons why we went pencils down. It's one of the reasons why we're not actively or aggressively pursuing acquisitions. Some of this has to settle down a little bit. Some sense of common sense has to be injected into this where they say, okay, we're causing damage now. We need to stop this and give investors some predictability of where interest rates, borrowing costs, and so on are headed. Because right now, no one seems to know. Are they going to stop at 5? Or if inflation persists, are they going to keep going to 10, 15, 20 like they did back in the early 80s? No one knows. And I don't trust them to say that they're not going to do something really stupid.
Yeah. Common sense, Brian. I think that's asking a lot from them, but
Indeed. We'll
see. And listeners, that's why when we're talking about floating rate product, that's why spreads are so wide right now, because the uncertainty is there. Banks, lenders, they just don't know where things are going. We were talking about a month ago, 25 basis point hike on the Fed funds rate come this month. And then a week ago, they were talking, no, it's probably going to be more like 50 basis points. And then this whole thing happened. So who knows where it's going to go? But I think to your point, Brian, that's why you keep underwriting deals until you find something, but don't get emotional in this business, right? Don't just make a deal because you need to put investor capital to work. Like Brian, I'm sure you're getting calls all the time from investors now asking, when's your next deal?
Oh, constantly. They want a place to put their money. They want to invest. They want to earn a return, but where do they put their money? No one really knows where to go. And I don't want to place it in real estate right now. So we're buying real estate debt. I mean, that's what we're doing because now I got somebody else's equity in first loss position. So we launched a real estate debt fund and we're buying real estate debt. I just think it's safer right now. We're playing defense, not offense. And it shouldn't be that way, but that's how it is.
Yeah. And I feel that the whole thing of people searching for yield, I feel that has been part of the reason why we've seen, like, yes, they have decompressed somewhat, but I don't think to the extent that most people thought. I think a lot of it has to do with because people are just searching for yield. So some are willing to take the risk of paying what they need to pay to get some type of yield or at least park cash. And will that continue? I have no idea.
Yeah. How much of that money is out there seeking that kind of a home? At first, 4% cap rates were persisting because you still had a lot of people that had 1031 up legs and they're like, hey, I already sold the property. If I don't buy something in 45 days, I'm going to pay the government $2 million. So they were buying under duress and still buying 4% cap rates. Eventually, you run out of those people. And now rational people who have to make investment decisions based upon investment reality, not tax reality, have to come in and buy this stuff and there's no takers. And the other problem is the flip side is the sellers are like, hey, I don't need to sell at an inflated cap rate. I'm doing just fine. The property is cash flowing. We're 95% occupied. Residents are paying the rent. We're hitting our pro formas. So we're under no pressure to sell. And I get that too. As an owner of some assets, we're under no pressure to sell ours either. Eventually, there's going to be some folks that had bad capital structure and they're going to be forced to sell. And that's going to cause some movement in the market. And really, what's going to cause cap rates to deflate is just simply going to be transaction velocity. Because I got news for you. The cap rates are already deflated. You just can't see it because nothing is selling. When things actually start to sell, the cap rates will reveal themselves. And I think we'll find that they're higher than people think.
Yeah. Talking about the capital structure, pain will come if you don't have the ideal capital structure for the environment you're in, right? A lot of people obviously had to buy bridge loans, which have a floating rate aspect. That's just what people were doing. But those that have long-term fixed rate debt, they're probably fine. How do you usually structure deals, Brian?
Yeah. So I don't hear a lot of people talk about, we do floating rate agency debt, which is long-term yet floating rate, and we do low leverage. So now that was a great strategy. And of course, we were laughing at all the fixed rate guys for like a decade because they would buy these fixed rate deals and then they'd want to sell them 3 years later when they doubled in value and found out they had to give all that value to their lender because they had a massive yield maintenance penalty to pay. Well, now the tables are turning. The fixed rate guys are laughing at us going like, haha, I've got a 3% interest rate and you're at 5 and my prepay's almost gone away. So now we're equal. We can all sell whenever we want, but I've got all this cash flow and you don't. And that's true. I mean, the floating rates have caused interest rates to go up, which has impacted our distributions because we have to pay somewhat higher rate. We do have rate caps. We have somewhat higher rate, but we also have rate cap replacements we're going to have to buy, and we have to make sure we reserve for that. So my defense has always just been to not borrow that much. So, I mean, our loan to value ratios range between 50 and 65% we own. So we've got plenty of cash flow to service our debt and pay for rate cap replacements and so on. So we aren't in any distress. The good news for us is if rates go down, our rate will go down and we can sell and pay no massive prepayment penalty. Yet the fixed rate guys will be back to, you know, prepayment penalty jail. So I still believe in that financing structure. If I were to buy something today, I'd probably still use a similar structure because our rate's going to go down eventually? Yeah, probably somewhat. Do I want to lock in fixed rate at the top? Probably not, because imagine if rates were low and stayed low, prepayment penalties were really, really bad on fixed rate debt. But when rates are high and then go low, the prepayment penalties are prohibitive. You absolutely cannot sell until that loan matures. I don't want to be stuck in that position either. So capital structure it's an important decision, but it's not a cut and dried easy choice like people like to think. Like if you're buying your own personal residence and you know whether you're going to hold it or sell it, you don't care. Fixed rate debt is great because you lock in your costs. You never have to worry, but you don't have the massive prepay. On commercial real estate, it's a very difficult and involved decision that has a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, I think that comes down to whatever your business plan is. Obviously, if it's buy and hold forever, then fixed is probably the best to go, as long as you're not at the top of the market. No, but thanks for sharing that. I think I've heard you mention that once before, and I've never heard anyone talk about that and that being their strategy. But to me, it makes sense. If you could even hit on, I think I've heard you mention before that there was like a 50-year study done between fixed and floating rate and how 50, 60-plus percent of the time floating rate has outperformed.
Yeah, that's right. That was a study that the CCIM Institute put out that studied a 50-year period of time and analyzed all the starting months. It broke down like however many hundreds of starting months. I guess it'd be like 50 times 12. So it's almost 600 starting months of whether you got fixed rate or floating and paid it off in 5 years. Would you pay more interest under fixed or floating? And it was like, I don't remember the exact number. It was like 60+% of the time floating rate won. Because the concept is you're getting paid to take the risk. But what the study did not include was in commercial real estate finance, you have this concept called yield maintenance. And yield maintenance is a prepayment penalty that basically you're telling your lender, I'm going to guarantee that you're going to get this rate. If I'm taking out a 10-year loan, you're going to get all the interest that you're entitled to for the entire 10-year period. That's essentially what you're saying. So if you pay it off in 5 years, you owe another 5 years of interest, I mean, in simple terms. So what the study from the CCIM Institute did not do was it didn't say, with all these starting months, if they were 10-year loans and paid off in five, what would be the percentage of winners versus losers if you factored in 5 years of yield maintenance penalty? And I think if you did that analysis, you would probably find floating rate winning roughly 95% of the time would be my guess. The only times when fixed rate would win would be the very months right before interest rates rapidly rise and stay there for a long period of time, because they would have to stay high for 5 years so you can sell and minimize the yield maintenance. And it would have to stay high for the floating rate debt to have gone high for a long period of time. That's the only instance where you're going to find that fixed rate will win. And the number of months that situation happens is very narrow. And I think in the last 50 years, it's probably only been a handful of months. Now, included in those months was probably any months in 2022.
Yep. It's all about timing. And hey, I'm a statistics guy. So if the numbers don't lie, right, Brian? So if that's what they say, I'm going to have to take a look at that, because we've bought floating before, but that's generally not our philosophy. But hey, like I said, numbers don't lie.
Yeah. Well, what I don't like is I don't like bridge.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people are using
as
bridge
debt. 2 years, 3 years, and then
you have a short maturity. That's exactly right. So there's two problems with bridge debt. One is that the spreads are a lot higher than agency floaters. So your starting interest rate is high. The second is your rate cap is generally quite high. So that means your exposure is pretty high. And then the third problem is they mature quickly. You got a 3-year maturity with 2 1-year extension options. Blink of an eye is 3 years. I mean, it's amazing how quickly 3 years will go by. And if you find yourself at year three with a property that's declined in value due to cap rate decompression, even factors outside of your control, and now only thing you can do is refi into much higher interest rates that coverage constrain lower than the amount of your debt, you've now got to go out and find new investors to bring in money to salvage this deal or lose it in foreclosure or sell it at a loss. And that makes you stuck. So the bridge is what I would stay away from. The floating is, it's riskier, but usually you're compensated handsomely for that risk, but bridge debt is toxic in my opinion.
Yeah. And it's the balloon payment that usually crushes people's careers.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the rate itself. So Brian is the founder and CEO of Praxis. So Brian, where does Praxis mostly operate geography wise? And what do you guys buy? It seems the interviews I've done, the more seasoned guys like yourself kind of pivot more towards Class A and Class B properties.
Yeah, so that's exactly where we're at. We're buying Class B to Class A. Right now, all of our holdings, I would call A minuses. We're mostly concentrated in the southeastern U.S., which have been kind of the high growth markets over the last decade or so. We also own in Arizona. We aren't buying anything in the coastal states right now, like California, New York, northeastern U.S. We don't do anything there. So pretty much from Arizona to Florida and most stuff in between is our territory, but 100 unit and up. Built after 1980, but we prefer built after 2000. Multifamily assets, that's pretty much our buy box.
There we go. Looking at your bio, you've done a little bit of everything. Obviously, we touched on starting off in single family homes, but it looks like you've done land, you've done storage. And I guess that'll lead me into one of the questions I always ask is why multifamily? Why multifamily as an investment vehicle?
Because I've done all the others and found that multifamily works the best.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen. We can drop the mic.
Right. I think in part, I'm better at it. In part, maybe it just works the best. I think it's scalable. It's sustainable. There's plenty of it out there. You can vary up your strategy to fit the particular markets that you're faced with. And we've just become very good at it. And I believe in sticking with what you're good at. When I was younger, I wasn't good at anything. So I tried everything and found what I was good at and stuck with it.
Hey, the riches are in the niches, right? At least that's what they say.
I like that.
So your book, right? What is one piece of advice or takeaway that you hope that most people would, there's probably dozens, but like what's one takeaway you'd wish someone would get from that book? And it's called The Hands-Off Investors, everybody.
Yeah, The Hands-Off Investor. That's it. This book was written with the passive investor in mind. Someone that has some capital to invest in a passive real estate syndication and doesn't really know the ropes of what that investment looks like, what that business looks like, how to find those investments, how to research those investments and figure out who they should be investing with and who they should be avoiding. This book was designed to answer those questions. And I think the biggest takeaway that I would hope anyone gets out of it is that the most important thing you can do is figure out the right sponsors to work with. And the sponsor is the company or person that's bringing the deal to the table and planning to operate this deal, manage this deal, buy this deal, and ultimately sell this deal. That individual or that company or that group is the most important factor to the success or failure of that investment. And you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this book is a friend of mine lost her entire life savings investing in a passive real estate syndication when it turned out that the sponsor was a crook and he took all the money and then fled with it. And then now he's sitting in jail and she's broke and she would have been set for life. And if I could just help one person avoid running into that same set of circumstances for themselves, then this book will be a success. So I think the takeaway is be very careful who you're investing with, do the proper research and due diligence, and this book will show you the way.
I love that. And I got started in this, Brian. Well, 2016, I got into real estate in one form or another, but specifically syndications about 5 years ago. And over the last 5 years, specifically probably in the last 2 to 3, we've seen a lot of people get into this business. And you get people claiming 3,000 units on their first 1 to 2 years of business. It can seem defeating for people like me, where it's like, no, I'm not there. But you just got to be careful of what people are promoting to you, because at 3,000, they could have a fraction of a percentage of ownership and they're not in the day-to-day management of that asset, right? And I think to me, it's really important to, like I mentioned earlier, and like you mentioned, look at the pilot, right? Pick due diligence on them. And I try to get that across as much as possible because, yeah, I never want to see anyone lose money. And I think a good question to ask any sponsor that you may be looking to do business with is, one, have they ever been, ask them about a loss and how did they handle it? Or ask them if they were to lose, if the deal was to lose money, what would they do and go from there? I just wanted to expound upon that. So thanks for sharing that. And listeners, if you haven't gotten the book, please, please get the book. It's a wonderful book. And he said it's for limited partners, but I've gotten so much value out of that book because I think it shows you, well, one, it shows you like what questions the limited partner should be asking you. And if they do ask you, you kind of see where they're coming from. So I highly recommend getting that book, and I'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because when I was pitching this book to the publisher, which is Bigger Pockets Publishing, I told them that the audience for this book was multifaceted. I mean, on one hand, the audience for this book is the high net worth passive investor. I said, but on the other hand, you also have another audience, and that's the people who are actually doing the syndications. The syndication sponsors are another audience for this book, because imagine that if you were about to begin a college course and you knew that at the end there was going to be a final exam. Would it help you if you had all the test questions and the test answers in advance? And that's basically what this book does for the syndication sponsor, because the proctor of this final exam is your passive investor. They're going to be asking you the questions and they're going to be grading your answers. And if you come prepared and you know, okay, investors want to know this, I need to know the answer. It not only helps you raise money, but it helps you become a better sponsor, because by knowing the answer means that you're going to do whatever that answer is that you should be doing, right? So yeah. A lot of people have skipped over a lot of that stuff and just figure, oh, you know, we'll wing it. But then when difficulties come along, then it's like winging it doesn't do it. You need to know what you're doing. And this will hopefully prompt people to, if they don't know what they're doing, to learn what they're doing before they take other people's money for a ride.
I agree. And I think it's important to have a mentor, and the mentor can be in the shape of a book that Brian wrote. So I think it's important, whatever it has to be. I think it's important to get educated and get educated from the right people, because there's a lot of people out there. I hit on this too a lot, Brian, but there's a lot of people that'll do a deal and then create a course. And you know, I'm not going to knock on people, but I think others that want to learn should do their due diligence on that end too. And I can tell you, I don't know Brian personally, and I'm not getting paid to promote his stuff, but I would highly recommend using Brian's, what he puts out as a resource. He's obviously, I hate the term, but he's obviously a guru in this space. So definitely take a look at that.
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence. This isn't what I do. You know, I'm not a mentor, yeah, a coach, a trainer, an educator. I wrote this book simply for the reason of two things. One, I wanted my investors to be better educated, because I noticed they weren't asking the right questions. And the second is I wanted sponsors to be more educated and step up their game and do a better job for their investors. I mean, that's why this book is out there. Maybe I'm a guru in the space, but I'm not a guru in the sense that the gurus that people think of. So I didn't write this book with the ulterior motive of making a profit on it. I don't make a living from writing books. I make a living by doing real estate deals and performing for my investors. This book was more of a sideshow, but if it helps people, then all the better.
Yeah, and I think those are the most important people to learn from. The ones that are not there to make a profit from it, but there to genuinely help and share some valuable advice.
Well, there's no upsell. Everything I know is in this 250 page or 350 page or however many page book it is. It's a thick book. There's no fill out the form at the end of the book to sign up for a $30,000 boot camp. I don't have any of that. So sorry.
And I was trying to find it for the show. I couldn't find my book this morning. I wanted to show it on screen, but yeah, it's a great book. It's kind of like a textbook, right? Of the do's and don'ts. But Brian, before I let you go and before I ask you the final four questions, where can people find you?
Well, our company is Praxis Capital. You can find us on the website for Praxis Capital, which is praxcap.com. It's praxcap.com. You can find me on Instagram at Investor Brian Burke. You can find me on Bigger Pockets in the forums, just answering questions for people in the discussion forums. You can find me on podcasts like Sean's podcast. And you can also check out the book at biggerpockets.com/syndication book or on Amazon.
Awesome. And we'll link all that in the show notes for sure.
Good stuff.
All right. Final four questions here. First question I usually ask, I already asked you, which is why multifamily as an investment. So I'll change it up kind of twofold here. What kind of lifestyle has investing in real estate created for you? And what type of legacy do you want to leave behind?
Well, you know, from a lifestyle perspective, one that I never would have imagined. I could not have imagined the life I have now, where I get to live part-time in Hawaii and live in a nice house and live a very comfortable life and travel the world and do a lot of things that I never would have imagined myself doing. I got freedom for my own time. I'm in control of my own schedule. It's absolutely incredible when people say living the dream. I think this is kind of at least representative of what that might look like. As far as a legacy is concerned, after I'm gone, people have long forgotten about me. So I'm not really too worried about that. I think probably my best legacy, if I could pull it off, would be to spend every dime I earn and have the last check written to the Undertaker and that bounces. I don't think I'm actually going to end up being able to pull that off because you have to time that just right. So
well, it sounds like you've had good timing.
Yeah, so far.
No, but hey, with that book will go on. So there could be some legacy right there.
There
you
go.
That's great. All right. Second question. What's a common mistake you see in real estate investors make? And you could take it from any angle, from a passive investor angle or active.
Well, I think probably the mistakes I most often see are they pay too much for property. They don't budget enough in repairs. They overestimate the resale value. That stuff is all pretty common, but the really fatal ones are they don't finance it properly. They borrow too much and get too far into debt. And debt is a good thing. It's a tool. I understand that, but you have to be careful enough that you don't debt your way into failure. So I think those are big ones that real estate investors make. Now, there's people who want to be real estate investors that haven't yet. And probably their biggest mistake is they give up probably about 10 minutes before they were about to have a breakthrough and succeed. They really just need to keep going. And eventually they're going to accomplish their goal if they keep after it consistently enough for long enough. So I would say they give up.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what's that book called? It's like 3 feet from gold, some feet from gold. That's exactly what it's about, right? And yeah, just I'm with you. Don't give up. All right. Third question. What is a resource that you often recommend to an investor, either just starting out, maybe intermediate? And obviously, this can be your book because that's what I'd probably refer. What's a resource?
I think the best resource I've found is biggerpockets.com. That website and the discussion forums and just the ability to ask questions and get responses from people of all walks. I mean, you'll get responses from people who are experienced and know what they're doing, and you'll get responses from people who don't have a clue what they're doing. And so it sometimes can be difficult to sort the good from the bad, but just to even have that resource is so incredible. When I started investing in real estate in 1989, the internet literally had just been invented. I mean, I was still dial-up connection where you had the modem that gave all the tones. I mean, there was no such thing as email. I mean, not to anybody had, and nobody had it. So the ability to have the technology that we have today and the ability to communicate with people and listen to podcasts like this and have people tell you their stories and how they were successful, all of these are things I did not have when I got into this business. So you're starting like 1,000 miles ahead of where I did. So anybody listening to this should be able to be far more successful than I'll ever be.
Well, that's saying a lot. 89, good year. That's the year I was born. So can't argue with that.
There you go. That's the year I got my first deed.
Oh, love it. Love it. All right. Last question, Brian. And every Friday I do a personal finance episode because that's my background. And I think it's important because it's obviously not what you make, but what you keep. So from that angle, from that lens, the good old time machine question. If you had a time machine, could go back to that younger Brian, 1989, and give him one piece of financial advice, what would that be?
People have asked me like about this before, like, you know, what would you do differently and that sort of stuff. And I think I don't know that I would give any advice at all because, and just like to the same question of people, like, what would you do differently? I wouldn't do anything differently at all. And the reason I say that, it sounds kind of weird, but the reason I say that is because you are built by your experiences, good or bad. And I will tell you, you will learn 3,000 times as much from something that goes wrong than you'll ever learn from anything that goes right. So it's not that you want to do anything differently, because who I am today is a combination of all the mistakes I've made, all the things I did right, all the things I did wrong. Change any one of those things, and I probably wouldn't be where I'm at today. I would be one of two places, way better off, in which case I can't give myself advice because I don't know what I should have done better to actually have been way better off, or I'd be way worse off because I didn't learn something I should have learned by experience. So I think my financial advice to my younger self would be just know everything you're going through is for a reason. Use it to your advantage and use it to motivate you to change the situation that you're unhappy with. Keep the stuff you're happy with and change what you're not happy with. And eventually you'll have accomplished your goals across the board.
I love that answer. That's a first on the show. Over 150 episodes, first on the show, but it makes a lot of sense, right? I've definitely learned the most from my failures, because when you do well, you just think you did everything perfect, even though you may not. It might have just been luck, right? And you don't necessarily learn anything. So I'm with you on that. Well, Brian, I really appreciate your time. Got to get you out on time. I think we're doing well. So thank you. I know you're a busy guy, so it means a lot for you to take time out and do this today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm honored to be here, Sean. Thank you for the invitation. I hope your listeners enjoy it.
Oh, I'm sure they will. And listeners, as always, easy doesn't pay well, and instant gratification is self-destructive. So not only get out there and work hard for your money, have your money work hard for you, so we can all create the lives of our dreams and make this world a better place. All right, catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review, and of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.